зараз йде вже третій рік війни.
It is now the third year of the war. During this time, the situation in our region, our part of the Black Sea, has changed significantly.
This is Mikhail Son. He works at the Institute of Marine Biology of the National Academy of Sciences of Ukraine in Odessa, which has been under Russian attack since the very start of the war.
In the first year, there were direct combat clashes. Most of it is shelling now. They take place quite regularly.
And all of the bombs, sunken warships, ship fuel and debris end up in the water. And that's not all.
Last year, a major technological disaster occurred, which involved the explosion of the dam of the Kakhovka Reservoir. When large masses of fresh river water flowed into our Ukrainian part of the Black Sea and significantly altered the conditions of existence for all marine ecosystems.
This dam on the Dnieper River provided water for the Kakhovka hydroelectric station in southern Ukraine. In the early hours of the 6th of June last year, the explosion released a vast amount of fresh water, destroying nearly everything in its path to the sea.
Firstly, a large number of species were carried into the Black Sea along with the water. That includes various terrestrial animals and plants, fish and invertebrates that ended up in the seawater and perished. Directly in the Black Sea, we witnessed the death of hundreds of millions of individuals of Black Sea mussels.
The Kakhovka dam water also carried with it pollution from the land, such as chemicals, fertilizers, sewage water and landmines. Rupturing the dam made a poor situation even worse. So what is happening with the Black Sea as a result of Russia's military aggression against Ukraine? And what can be done to save this environment?
Ocean Calls.
Hello and welcome to Ocean Calls, the podcast in which we plunge into the issues making waves on our blue planet. I'm your host, Euronews science reporter Jeremy Wilkes. The war in Ukraine isn't over yet, and there are a lot of questions around how the Black Sea has been impacted by the conflict. Scientists there face many restrictions, and it could be years or even decades before the picture is clearer. However, there are lessons to be learned from history, in particular the First and Second World Wars. Joining me to discuss this in our first episode of the new season are Professor Jens Greinert from the Geomar Helmholtz Center for Ocean Research in Kiel, Germany, whose research is aimed at the safe removal of unexploded ordnance in the North Sea and the Baltic. Hi, Jens.
Hi there.
And Markus Hellevuori, the Professional Secretary at the Baltic Marine Environment Protection Commission, whose expertise lies in understanding and mitigating the impact of unexploded ordnance in the Baltic Sea region. Hi, Markus.
Hello.
And at the end of the conversation, we'll hear an unusual ocean tale from marine archaeologist Dr. Rodrigo Pacheco Ruiz about the Black Sea Map Project and learn more about the incredible history of this ancient place believed to be at the origins of the biblical flood. Okay, now let's jump into our conversation. Have you ever seen any of this unexploded ordnance up close, touched it, smelt it, been a bit scared by it, Jens?
Yeah, we have seen this. So since 2016, Geomar is doing research around marine munition. And we have a lot of this in the German Baltic Sea. And we went out with our vessels several times. And we sometimes use even divers or we send down video cameras. But the very first time we sailed out with a little vessel, the water depth was quite shallow. So there was less than 10 meters between the hull of the vessel and large sea mines and ground mines. It gives you a little bit of a creepy feeling.
I'm sure.
When you sail over large ground mines that could blow this little vessel to the outer space. And it was strange feeling. And we ask ourselves, why are we doing this? This is insane. But over the years, you get used to it.
Okay. And Markus?
Luckily, I have not seen any of them up close. It sounds a bit scary, to be honest. But no, I'm working more on the policy and governance side of this and not out in the field. And HELCOM is just about to publish a new assessment on this topic for the Baltic Sea and also maps that are on our website.
I suppose just for anybody who's never even heard of this concept, what is it and why is it there?
Two things that are there. So it's the munition that has been deployed during war activities. Yeah, there could be sea mine barriers. So sea mines are these round things with the little spikes on top. So they are swimming in the water. And there are other mines, ground mines, which lie on the seafloor. And that's, for example, what happened in the Ukrainian war as well, outside of Odessa. But then in Germany, after the war, and in many other countries after the Second World War and also after the First World War, old munition that was still lying around on land has been dumped. They wanted to get rid of the old munition. And in Germany, particularly the Allies said, we have to demilitarize Germany as quickly as possible.
Right.
And one way is to get rid of the weapons. So the tanks and the flak and cannons and that's such kind of things, but also of the munition.
Mm.
But Germany was packed with munition and they thought, what are we doing with this estimated 1.6 million tons of munition? And then the Allies said, let's throw it into the water.
Brilliant idea.
They realized it's not a smart idea because it's not gone. It's just out of sight. But this is what happened. So in particularly in German waters, we have a lot of this sea dumped munition, which is a little bit different because it doesn't have fuses in them. So they cannot explode so easily than the munition that has been deployed during war activities.
Right. Okay. And then further up, Marcus, you're up in Finland, I believe.
Yes.
Is it the case there also that you've got this stuff hanging around from the First and Second World War that's been dumped in the water?
Yes, in particular, well, more of the unexploded ordnances or mines, but there are also dumped munitions, not only in these main dumping sites in the southern Baltic Sea, but also further north.
So how does that situation in the Baltic compare with the Black Sea? Well, there are similarities, according to Ukrainian expert Mikhail Son.
In the Black Sea, there is a problem, for example, with mines and some unexploded shells from World War II, just like on land. So it's very common in situations where someone somewhere, either in a garden or on a beach, sees an unexploded shell or mine from World War II.
Marcus, do we have stories then of these things exploding and causing damage to ships not during a time of conflict?
I think that's quite rare, actually. They have been encountered every now and then, but luckily there hasn't been any serious incidents, at least not in recent years. But there's been mainly more like a health risk with these compounds, especially in chemical weapons that have been dumped that wash up on the beaches.
I mean, if you have chemical munition, this is simply toxic and it's immediately toxic, so you can die. But the explosives, we call it the conventional munition, is a mixture of different chemical compounds. And one of them, for example, is TNT. So that's the most prominent one. And TNT has a benzoyl ring, so they are carbon isotopes in a kind of ring structure. And those benzoyl rings are typically carcinogenic and mutagenic. So you don't want to have this stuff in the water. And if this goes into the environment, and that's what we proved through our studies starting 2016, we can actually measure TNT in the environment, in the water, in the sediment, but also in fauna. So we see it, for example, in mussels, we see it in fish, and we see it in other in little worms, and you name it, yeah. Luckily, at the moment, still to very low concentrations. Mm. Let's say, okay, most of the fauna is not toxic for human seafood consumers. But in some locations at those munition dump sites, there are areas 20 by 30 meters in size, 1 meter high, one bomb next to the other. Right. It looks really like dumping stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if you for example, analyze clams or muscles from those locations where bomb next to bomb, sometimes some are broken and small caliber munition is lying around. They can have concentrations where the toxicologists say, this clam you should better not eat.
Really?
Yeah. So typically, those areas are marked in nautical charts. Mm. Because it would be dangerous, for example, to anchor there.
Yeah.
Fishing is not allowed. Any type of bottom contact is not allowed. So people know they shouldn't do this and they should not go fishing, and they don't do this. Fishermen do not fish there. But that's
the case in the Baltic and the North Sea at the moment, right? We sort of know where this stuff is at the moment,
more or less.
We kind of know where it is. Yeah, we kind of know where it is, and this number of 1.6 million tons is a very rough estimate. Yeah, so people try to use archive data, for example, that. Wrote or where it's written how much munition the army or the navy or whatever the air force in Germany had at the end of the Second World War. And then people, of course, wrote down that there was a ship sent out with this amount of munition of this type and should dump it somewhere over there. But this was pre-GPS.
This is chaotic times, and I'm sure absolutely. The captain of those ships didn't really necessarily want to have that load on board, didn't want to do the job either. Marcus, to what extent have we got a map for the Baltic that's accurate?
We have a map that's pretty accurate of where the dumping grounds are, and also maps that show where some munitions have been encountered. But we also know that that's not the full story, that there are munitions that are elsewhere. And we also know the routes that were taken by the ships that went out to dump munitions. Right. And we know that some of them started dumping already along the route because they wanted to be efficient and not, you know, spend that much time at the designated site dumping. They could go home
for sure, which is entirely understandable.
Already.
Yeah.
So we know a lot, but we also know that there are still gaps.
It sounds messy already in a place where you have a lot of very serious and reasonable governments and no war going on at the moment, talking about around the Baltic. To what extent is there proper cooperation to clean it up at the moment in the Baltic and the North Sea, actually, Marcus?
Well, there isn't any coordinated cleaning up going on. We are maybe not quite there yet. I would say one thing that from the HELCOM point of view is still missing is agreed procedures of how actually to go about doing this. One way of getting rid of the problem is to just blow up the bombs.
Possibly easier said than done, I'm guessing, as well.
Yeah, but still, I think that's one of the easiest solutions.
Okay.
And then it's no longer a risk for ship safety, for instance. Mm. But then that causes environmental consequences, of course. Mm.
Jens, what are the options that we've got?
I think there are a lot of efforts actually to get rid of munition, particularly for these offshore wind parks and cable routes and pipelines. Wherever you are in the Baltic and you want to put something on the ground for infrastructure constructions, you have to clear the area of munitions. Sometimes you have an object that you cannot touch and that you cannot move, but that you have to get rid of, and then you have to do an in-place detonation, which is not good for the environment because you have a high pressure wave, so mammals could get really severely injured, they can die, and you potentially also contaminate the area with these carcinogenic explosives.
Let's switch back now to the Black Sea to hear from another Ukrainian expert, Viktor Komarin, the head of the Ukrainian Scientific Center for Marine Ecology, a leading environmental protection organization in the country. He says the explosion at the Kakhovka Dam meant harmful substances, including chemicals called PCBs, were released into the water. They'll be nigh on impossible to clean up and pose a threat to people's health.
As a result of the emergency situation, a large amount of oil products, heavy metals, chlorinated compounds such as lindane, and highly toxic polychlorinated biphenyls have entered the water. These are industrial origin substances that only occur in nature as a result of human influence. It is necessary to note that they have several properties. Firstly, they are highly toxic. And secondly, they have the property of accumulating throughout all trophic levels of the ecosystem, from simpler organisms like shrimps, for example, to fish and dolphins. Then, after the fish caught is consumed by humans, it can consequently harm humans.
The problem of old munitions polluting the waters around Europe is more widespread than many people think. In fact, if you have sensitive enough equipment, you can find it all over the place. Back to our conversation with Marcus and Jens.
So we had a bunch of cruises, I don't know, 10 or more, going to the Baltic repeatedly, and we take water samples and we take sediment samples, and there is not one water sample where we can't detect munition compounds, but to very low concentration. So the point is, if you look very closely and you have sophisticated systems to analyze something, you find something. And we can do this. So we are very sensitive in our analysis. But there's no water column without any TNT or metabolites of TNT.
In the Baltic, you're talking about?
In the Baltic.
In the North Sea?
In the North Sea, the same, but the concentrations are only a tenth, because the tidal exchange and the currents in the North Sea is much larger than in the Baltic.
Yeah.
But the Black Sea, you also have close to no water exchange. Yeah. Black Sea is a basin. I mean, it even gets anoxic below 120 meters or so.
Yeah.
So this is a pond where things can accumulate over the time, which is not good. And the fear that we have in the Baltic Sea now is that after close to 80 years after the Second World War, the metal shells, they will corrode more and more. So they will release over time more and more of these toxic substances. And we hope to be in front of the wave where we get the stuff out before it comes to the massive corrosion and release of toxic substances. So that's what we hope.
Yeah. Marcus, is there awareness, political awareness of this in your region at least?
Yes, I think there is, and that awareness is right now really increasing as well. And it's just because of what Jens said. I mean, most of these munitions are still encased in their shells and quite sort of just laying around and not causing any problems yet, at least on a greater level. But when they start, and they are currently, you know, rusting and disintegrating, the substances will be released more and more.
What's happening at EU level? You know, what do we have coming from Brussels to deal with this?
So Brussels, I mean, they recognized the issue. Even the European Parliament once signed a petition. Ursula von der Leyen even signed a letter and said, we have to do something more about this. So the EU, Brussels gives money for research projects to investigate environmental issues, to develop technologies, to detect munitions in a better way. This is always a little bit dual use, because the military also wants to find munition, but the environmentalists also want to find munition. Now the technologies are the same.
But I'm guessing, Marcus, that you have meetings with military people about this. Are they willing to play ball and cooperate on it?
Well, they are cooperating, and we have, to some extent, have had some contacts with them. But it's also a sensitive topic, and the military may have different priorities and concerns than, for instance, environmental organizations. And this is why cooperation and negotiation is important.
In the Black Sea, the problems continue to accumulate. Here's Viktor Komarin from the Ukrainian Scientific Center for Marine Ecology again.
With the onset of active combat operations, a large amount of damage has been inflicted, not only on the marine environment, but on the environment in general. All impacts on the marine environment can be divided into two main components. There are the impacts that occur due to the destruction on the coast, and those impacts that directly affect the Black Sea. This includes sunken ships, airplanes, explosions, rockets, and bombs, which in one way or another end up in the marine environment and affect its inhabitants. Speaking of the coastal impact, it's clear that when entire cities are affected, infrastructure is affected, sewage treatment facilities are destroyed, and all waste is mixed. All toxic substances end up in the marine environment, which has a very negative impact on its inhabitants.
Okay, so let's go back to our conversation with Marcus and Jens.
Overall, what would you say would be recommendations, I suppose, from the experience that we've had in Western Europe that could be passed over as sort of good practice for the future that the Ukrainians could be thinking about already to try and keep track of what is where?
So what we did and what we actually wrote reports about is monitoring strategies to map over longer time and measure over longer time the contamination of different chemical compounds. So we know exactly how we have to take samples, how to analyze them, what kind of mass spectrometers we need, and these kind of things that you also have to consider current directions. So all these methodologies, they are in place and they can one-to-one be applied to the Black Sea. That's absolutely no problem. And we can provide all this information. That's can be done.
Marcus, can I bring you in on that?
Yes. In addition, I think the cooperation between the countries and the on the policy side as well on how to address the issue once you know the situation through the monitoring, etc. That's also something that we would be very willing to assist Ukraine and the other countries in the Black Sea region with. And this is something that we are already in discussions with the Black Sea Commission, which is HELCOM's sister organization, another regional sea convention in the Black Sea, and about cooperation and lessons learned in the Baltic Sea.
I would imagine that at a certain point it does get to a lot of finger pointing about who is responsible, because it could be the person who made the weapons, it could be the person who brought the weapons in the first place, it could be the person who dumped the weapons, or it could be the responsibility of the country who is responsible for that part of the sea where the weapons end up being dumped. What's the current thinking on that in terms of, like, whose job is it really to do this?
Yeah. Well, this is a very difficult question. And one aspect, you know, to consider is that when these weapons were dumped, they probably didn't break any laws when doing that, because the London Convention on that prohibits dumping only came in the 70s. And it used to be common practice, not only for munitions, but wastes of other types were dumped in the sea. And this was seen as a big dumping site where things just disappear. But now
yes,
we know better,
of course. Infinite place where you can just dump things and they'll go away. Yeah,
but now we know better, and now we have a difficult question of determining who is responsible. My understanding is that the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, UNCLOS, according to that, it is the countries in which waters this is what would be responsible for taking any action that they can to reduce the risks and harm to the environment. But this is, you know, a complicated legal question, definitely.
It sounds terribly complicated. A minefield, dare I say, pardon the pun, but because obviously it's not necessarily your fault if somebody dumps something in your waters. Jens, what's your understanding of the situation on that?
So what Marco said, that after the Second World War, the dumping of the munition, this is potentially they didn't break any laws at that time. And there is a little bit the consensus that at least in Western European countries, the country that has the issue is now responsible.
So Poland is cleaning up the Polish area. Germany is cleaning up the German area. Has anybody actually cleaned up all of their sea now?
No. They only start cleaning when they have to. So this infrastructure, putting pipelines, cable routes, offshore wind parks.
The future for green energy visions that people love telling me about is the North Sea becoming absolutely filled with massive wind turbines.
Yeah, and they have to clean up a lot of munition. But these are not, because the dump sites are not in the middle of the North Sea. They are quite close to shore.
But there it's Denmark that's doing it. It's not the people who are laying the cables who are doing it. It's actually the Danish government, for example, or the British government that's doing it. No,
it's the companies who build up the wind parks. They hire unexploded ordnance companies to remove it. So they pay, and this all comes on top of how much you have to pay then for the energy at the end.
And
of
they
the
don't
day.
Send the bill onto the government saying that we did the job for you.
No.
Crazy, isn't it, that situation? Of course it's in their interest to clean it up, but it's not their responsibility. The mess is there.
So
basically there's no country who's like the good pupil at school and has cleaned up its whole patch.
No. I think it's quite a big task as well, because it depends a bit on what country we're talking about. We're talking about vast areas, large amounts, and it's going to be a very costly and time-consuming operation if someone wants to clean up everything.
Final question then, what would you say to the Ukrainians now? What would be your message to them in the situation that they're in at the moment, which is terrible, to try and look after the Black Sea? What do we do?
They are facing, of course, a very terrible situation where perhaps some random mines or munitions in the sea is not on the top of their list of concerns at the moment. But of course, it would be really good if you know, when possible, they would try to address the situation sooner rather than later.
There might be a little bit of an advice. So one thing is that we are facing quite often is not knowing exactly where munition has been dumped in the past. I mean, potentially the Russians will not tell where they dumped their munitions, but if the Ukrainians, I don't know whether they do this to secure their own water, they could also put up minefields. They should have a good bookkeeping about where they put their mines to be able to remove them quickly.
Yeah.
So this is one thing. This is a very simple advice. The second is, if hopefully the war is over sooner than later, they should not dump munition in the water. They should keep it on land and try to dispose it on land so that they do not push it in the water. Mm. The only wish is that the war is over as quickly as possible.
Well, that's a wish that everyone shares here at the Ocean Calls team. My thanks to Marcus Helivuori, Jens Greinert, Mikhail Son and Viktor Komarin for that fascinating conversation. And now to the part of our podcast in which a famous figure in their field shares their most impactful marine experience. In this episode, you'll hear from Dr. Rodrigo Pacheco Ruiz, a maritime archaeologist who explored the depths of the Black Sea and discovered something incredible. I won't spoil it for you. Here's his story.
My name is Rodrigo Pacheco Ruiz. I've worked in the past on deep sea archaeological explorations. There is quite a lot of studies that have postulated that the Black Sea was flooded really quickly at some point in the Bronze Age. That event could have been the origins of the biblical flood, so Noah's Ark and all these myths and legends. So the Black Sea Map project was a project that was designed to run for 5 or 6 years of research and exploration. We were poised with a question of what happened in the Black Sea in the last 20,000 years. As we went through mapping the seabed and understanding sea level change, we found more than 65 new shipwrecks and in conditions that no one has ever seen before. The Black Sea, it's a different sea from all of the other seas. It's called an anoxic basin, which means that there is no oxygen after a certain depth. So there's no oxygen for the usual bacterias and biological agents that could degrade things that are organic material. The temperature down there is very stable, so it's almost the perfect fridge. So we found wooden ships that are very old, some of them dating back to 5,300 years old. The oldest one we found is a Greek shipwreck, which we believe is the oldest, best preserved wreck in the world. You can still see the masts. You can still see the thwarts where the rowers will be sitting down. You can still tell the deck. So all the components of the hull that are made out of wood and that normally don't survive in the Mediterranean because of the bacteria and of all the biological agents that are eating them out survived in this case. In particular, this Greek one was a particularly small ship. So you can think of it as the size of a bus, probably a little bit bigger than that. It will carry enough people to, you know, use it for trade, moving around the different ports in the Black Sea. So all the Roman wrecks, all the Byzantine wrecks, all the Greek shipwrecks that we found, they were all found in blue waters, meaning that for days and days they won't be able to see any land. They were really skilled navigators, and they were not afraid to just go on and do open water, blue water sailing. Success stories in archaeology and failures in archaeology are very important for us in the future. We can understand what people were going through with the tools they had in the past. So why did a shipwreck sunk, for example, which is one of the most difficult questions to ask? What was the reason a ship sunk? Was it because it was badly constructed? Was it because there was, you know, negligence from someone, or because it's just a storm sunk it? All these things we're trying to understand so we can apply this knowledge and be better people today, or be more prepared because we have more evidence of how people reacted to such a thing as sea level change, especially today where we have overwhelming issues regarding this topic.
Thanks to Rodrigo for that superb ocean tale.
Ocean Calls.
You've been listening to Ocean Calls, a bi-monthly podcast for Friends of the Sea, in which we break down science and share interesting ocean facts. If you like this episode and want to learn more, go to the Euronews YouTube channel and listen to a longer version of this conversation. To know more about our guests and their work, check the links in the description. I'm your host, Jeremy Wilkes, and this show is produced by Naira Dablashian and Natalia Olsner. The sound editing is by Jean-Christophe Marco, and sound mixing is by Mathieu Duchesne. Our editor-in-chief is Sophie Claudet. Ocean Calls is produced in partnership with the European Commission's Directorate General for Maritime Affairs and Fisheries.